Welcome to the Innovation Calling Podcast,
where we connect creators for the next big thing. We're your hosts, Erin Greger
and Sia Yasotornrat.
Hey, it's Erin Greger.
And it's Sia Yasotornrat.
All right, before we get into this episode, we have an announcement. It is not a Women in Tech podcasing series, although we have one September 3rd. Go to our website. But this is a big one. Sia, I'm going to give you the honors of this official announcement.
We are super stoked to announce our first business podcast forum here at City Central North Dallas on September 30th.
Yes. So this is an event focused on helping people who are like running a business, who are utilizing podcasts or thinking about utilizing podcasts to grow their business, whether it's within connecting to their current audience, future customers, or even internally. If you're looking at the podcast medium, then this is an event you definitely want to check out.
Absolutely. If you think of a one-to-many communication, podcasts are the best medium for it, and it's evergreen.
Yes.
So if you're looking at stretching your marketing dollars, podcasts are the way to go.
Yep. So it's a day-long event, September 30th. Join us at City Central. Lunch will be provided. We're ending with a happy hour and a live comedy podcast. Throughout the day, we've got speakers. We'll have full podcast recordings. It's going to be a really fun event and one I promise you will walk away learning a lot from. So jump over to our website, innovationcalling.com. Go to the events tab and you'll see it there. So this episode, Mr. Adam.
Yes, Mr. Adam Pershke. He is the CEO and founder of Novum. The thing is, Erin, do you ever talk to someone that is so smart, you just look at them and your eyes kind of gloss over?
Yeah.
That is how I felt with Adam. And for someone as youthful as he looks, man alive, he's pretty much done everything and anything. All the hashtags, AI, cybersecurity,
IoT, 5G,
esports, just his participation and support through hackathons. I mean, this guy's done it all. He kind of makes me feel lazy.
Yeah. No, it's hard to make me feel lazy, and he made me feel lazy. So
you're right. So I think on that note, we're really proud and honored that we got to spend some time with Adam Pershke, CEO of Novum.
All right. Welcome to another episode of Innovation Calling. I'm Erin Greger.
And I'm Sia Yasotornrat.
All right, Adam, welcome. Very happy to have you here. I know C has been talking about you for a very long time. So excited to see you and have you here. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
No pressure, Adam.
No, you better be good. That's all. Don't touch the table and you better be really intriguing.
and don't make that booming voice, radio voice of yours show ours up, right?
Okay. Exactly.
Welcome to Innovation Calling.
We're going to clip that out and use that.
He's going to have to be our voiceover guy.
I know. We'll get you some extra work if you want it. I know you're kind of busy doing like other things.
Everything?
Yeah, everything.
I mean, talk about someone that is like a jack of all trades. Yeah. I mean, every time I talk to Adam, he's like, oh, hey, by the way, I've been talking to so-and-so. Totally different industry, totally different, like everything. And I'm like, dude, like, where's your brain go, Adam? Like, you are the quintessential entrepreneur. Do you agree or disagree?
Agree.
Wow, that was a really good one.
Yeah.
And the podcast is over. Thank you very much, Adam.
You're so welcome.
Well, and Adam is a very good one because we've got a lot of hashtags. We always joke about like the key terms in technology.
Oh, boy.
And you've got it's Novum. Is that how? Okay. And Novum. IoT, blockchain, cybersecurity, you got a lot of them. And we want to dig into more about your business because I know there's a lot of people talking about these key terms. There's a lot of people, I don't want to say doing what you're doing because I know what you're doing is very proprietary and differences, and we want to get into that. So can you talk a little bit about Novum and the story behind it?
Yeah. So Novum actually started with our previous company in 2016. Are you familiar with malware?
Yes.
Okay.
Unfortunately, yes.
So in 2016, the same founders were doing another company and we had exclusive contracts with the leading HPE OEM in the surveillance space. So 50,000 cameras worldwide, multi-government embassies, casinos, cruise ships, stadiums, you name it. We were doing identity and access management. We were creating this solution for them, which is now patented, so they can go resell it. Now, with that, we started noticing malware attacks on IoT devices. And traditionally, you don't think of an access management panel, you know, where you swipe your card or your badge, as something that can be hacked.
Right.
On top of that, you don't think of surveillance cameras that can be hacked. Usually you say, okay, well, I put them behind a network, so they're safe. They're not safe. So we started seeing all of these attacks, and since we were in the identity and access management space, we said, okay, there has to be a way that we can look at that visibility of traditional and non-traditional IoT, or managed and unmanaged IoT. On top of that, we have to look for ways that we can prevent those from being hacked the best as possible. And I'll put it out there right now. No solution is 100%. Cybersecurity is a multi-layered approach to it. So Mirai botnet happened. They connected to default username and credentials to these IoT devices, 19 different manufacturers. They produced the largest DDoS attack to date, or till that date, in the world. They attacked then with those DDoS attacks, Amazon's Eastern Seaboard and other large corporations, all because of default username and credentials.
That's not when it was that when AW3 completely went down. Did that have anything to do with that? Remember that a couple years ago, like the whole world was ending because AW.
Yeah. So AWS.
Or AWS. AW3. Sorry.
Yeah. So AWS and Dyn, D-Y-N, they were attacked. They're the largest CDN, CDS network in the world. And they said, we've never seen an attack this large, and all of everything that we had to prevent it didn't do anything. We've never seen so much traffic.
Wow.
So that's kind of where Novum started. And we were then, we just decided to do research on that for the next couple of years. Blockchain was fairly new. Blockchain is still fairly new. IoT, in terms of what it is and what it's being dubbed as, you know, people think of IoT as my Nest thermostat. Sure. Absolutely. IoT may be a camera, a surveillance camera that's connected. But what about your parking infrastructure? What about the gate that lifts up in a city in a parking garage that has firmware on it? It's an IoT, but it's not what you would consider an IoT device. It's a non-traditional IoT device. Well, that can be infected. And then that can go up into a network, and now you have problems.
You just have all these new entry points.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so isn't that the fundamental problem with the whole smart cities and everything's being interconnected and everything's over IP? Do you think that has slowed down deployment or adaption outside of the money? Let's take that out, right? But if, okay, assuming we had $1 billion to spend, could you argue security around that is prohibiting just the mass distribution of it? Or do you think people don't care?
Right now, people do care, like a CISO, a chief information security officer of a city. We've talked to a few of the major cities in the U.S. and said, look, we love IoT. IoT does a lot of great things for our city, for management of it, and just the efficiency. But we have to assess not just what the IoT device does, but the security on the IoT device, how we're going to manage that within a system, in our entire system. Are we segmenting for every single IoT device? And that would be, for example, surveillance systems. You put all of those cameras on one segmented network. Okay, well, now you expand that and you have 50,000 different segmented networks. Now, how do you manage those? How do you see all of those devices? And you can see where it gets very complicated very quickly. So in terms of IoT, there's push from both enterprise and from the mayor's office to say, oh, we need IoT devices for XYZ. So then it's being pushed down to other entities within it, within a city, to be able to assess that and bring them in for testing. For example, with Dallas, we have our living lab in the historic district. Well, that's great. And I think all of these cities are going to eventually get those types of labs. But where's the security?
Mm-hmm.
Where is the control of these devices? Yeah.
Are people thinking of that? Like, do they realize the as you're talking to city officials, and this is no offense, like I'm not a technical person, so I'm not looking down my nose at anybody, but they're not going to be the most technical. They're going to see, okay, we need this. So-and-so's doing this. Do they understand all these implications, or is there a lot of education on your end too when you're coming in and working with these organizations?
So it depends on the city.
Yeah.
It depends on the city. Some CISOs that we've talked to absolutely understand that there is a problem. It needs to be solved. It's not currently being solved in terms of visibility.
Mm-hmm.
So just base level visibility, not even security. If I can't see my device, I don't know how to protect it. I don't know what to do to manage it. I don't know what compliance I need to follow, like a NIST compliance, yeah, to be able to say I'm 100% in compliance. So this also goes into the enterprise. It's the same thing. There are unmanaged devices coming in. Bring your own device as well. When they're connecting, do they have something installed on them? If they have something installed, what happens and how do you mitigate that because it's not your corporate device? And so on. So there are so many different ways to look at it, but the visibility on a base level is the real problem. So based on that research we did from 2016 to 2018, we started developing and architecting a way to transcend a network, essentially, and find these different managed and unmanaged IoT devices. And that's where Novum really stands. So first and foremost, it's visibility.
So, okay, I don't hear about blockchain as much as I used to.
Mm-hmm.
Where are you guys at with Novum as far as, you know, because you have to use IoT devices in order for blockchain and the ledger system to send that data across whatever, right? I mean, so are you working in partnership with IoT manufacturers and helping them develop as they leverage blockchain for their business? So where is Novum actually sitting? I guess I'm still a little bit confused.
Yeah. So in terms of blockchain, you can do a bunch of different things with blockchain and IoT. The problem you have is that IoT devices have low RAM. They have low memory, just generally in storage. So how the blockchain works, if I want to put a million devices on the blockchain and then run a node or run something on an IoT device, it doesn't have, like, the majority of them don't have enough storage space or RAM to be able to support what it was created to do.
On top of that.
And on top of a blockchain node computation. So we've taken it off of IoT devices or what people think that they can do, and I'm sure it will be possible eventually, but it doesn't make sense now to be able to do that. So right now, our blockchain is run inside of the cloud. You know, it's scalable vertically or horizontally for any organization. And you also get into the conversation, though, of is it a public blockchain? Is it a private or permission blockchain? Is it a hybrid of the two? Which is, it means you basically have a private, but you can anchor out data onto a public blockchain to be able to use it as a separate point in case somebody was to hack your private blockchain. And so there are different ways you can do it and depends on the organization that's doing that.
So I was researching about what you do, and I'm going to totally preface this with I am not a blockchain expert, nor do I claim to be next week. You may re-ask because I may be, but just kidding. But I noticed when for the technology you use, it was discussed about distributed ledger technology. And I thought blockchain was ledger, so I had to do some research. Can you describe the difference between the two and why you decided to go with distributed ledger versus standard blockchain?
So that's a great question. The base layer of what blockchain is a distributed ledger.
That's what it was. So
yes, that's why I was very confused.
So yes, it depends on how you architect it, where it can hypothetically be a block, which makes it a blockchain.
Right.
So you have data, it's put into a block, there's computation, it's proven that something is confirmed or not confirmed based on what you're trying to find out, and then more information comes in, it gets put into the next block, and then that's computated, and then it goes on and on and on and on in a straight line. Now, DLT, or distributed ledger technology, has different variations, and you're starting to see that with companies like Facebook, or a Hashgraph, or even AWS has their own quantum ledger database, which allows you to do it more like a Merkle tree. Just think of it, you know, a hierarchy. You have one block and it can spread out unlimited spaces, and that way it's more scalable, it's more secure, the transactions happen faster. And so you can see both of those, but on the base layer, blockchain does have a distributed ledger technology underneath it.
If it trickles down though, how does it become more secure? Like if more areas can grab it, how is it more secure?
Yeah, can it get corrupted some way?
Yeah.
That's what I don't understand. And I think if you see my face right now, it's like, I don't, I'm trying to visualize this. So help me, can take it back.
Yeah. Yeah. So in terms of blockchain and how that would work, really, if you go back to Bitcoin, there is this problem that was solved called the double spending problem. Essentially, if I gave you a dollar and then I gave you a dollar, and then I don't technically have any dollars left. I had $2, but then I was able to take your dollars back and duplicate my dollars. Then all of a sudden I have $4. So this double spending was a problem, and Bitcoin actually solved this problem. So yeah, I mean, essentially based off of that and the way that you do it, you can expand that blockchain into multiple chains that talk to each other, essentially. So you're spreading out. I guess a better way to explain it would be think of distributed computing, okay. Right? So I start up a node in AWS or some cloud, and all of a sudden that gets overloaded. So now I start up another instance of it. That gets overloaded. I start up another instance, or I start up 1,000 instances to do the load balancing of it. So that's a better way to explain how a DLT works in mm-hmm. terms of being expanded, and with that expansion, and similar to just general blockchain, the more blocks you have, the more secure it becomes, because okay. the longer the chain that you have.
Okay. Yeah, that's blockchain newbie stuff for me.
Well, no, I mean, we actually had this conversation with CJoy, and he's yes. probably cringing right now going, Sia, damn it, we talked about this.
But not to this level.
Well, it's also a few months ago.
Yeah.
So, yeah, blockchain's an interesting space. There's a ton of conversation going around public, private, permissioned, or hybrid approach. And when you're an enterprise looking at this type of blockchain technology that you want to bring in to your enterprise, I would say first understand what you or maybe a consortium would want to do. You have the Ethereum Alliance right now.
Yeah.
Tons of enterprise have joined, but they've honestly joined because they didn't understand the technology. So right. if I can understand the biggest and the most used public blockchain and use cases towards it, I can then look at that in terms of maybe a private or a hybrid blockchain. Enterprise in itself for production ready commercialization of blockchain, to date, I haven't seen anything on the public blockchain spectrum. I've seen anchoring, but typically you have something that's within your organization. You can run a blockchain to it. You can invite others that are in your space, whether you're partnered with them or they're in your marketplace and you need data that transmutes to it. You can do that. And so for ours, it's similar. Mm-hmm. So if we're working with the government, 100% government's going to say, yeah, great. Well, we don't want a public blockchain. We want something that we can control, or that a managed service that has our contract for a specific city can control in some way, shape, or form. Now, there are debates if that's good or bad, or a positive or negative, because somebody can do something negative or bad to the blockchain, corrupt the data, change the right. data. But if you change data on a blockchain, say from last year, it has to change everything on the chain. So you're going to see that exact instance that something has changed. So you know that something's wrong, and then you can go and look at that in a deeper way.
Right. But they know, though, if there's been an anomaly, they'll toss it, right? Because it's just an anomaly, maybe someone trying to attack whatever. And that's why blockchain is infallible, as far as, because there's so much other nodes out there that will validate, no, at this timestamp, it looked like X.
Yeah. So that is why you're starting to see anchoring with some of the enterprise blockchains for, just, let's just say, like contract signatures or notaries. So some of those types of businesses will do an internal blockchain on the cloud. It's fully scalable, but then they may anchor data points that are encrypted, you know, just hashed onto a public blockchain. So even if theirs was corrupted in some way, they have batches that were basically put onto Bitcoin or Ethereum's blockchain that has been going for years. So to try and attack something like that would be too costly.
So, which makes sense with the whole cybersecurity perspective of it too, because you're hopefully protecting everything. And then, because I know we talked about this previously when we were at Bitdefender, when we talked about like a lot of cybersecurity isn't necessarily, you know, obviously it's a protection, but then also how do you recover after an attack? Do you all consider that and help with that too? So obviously, let's be, I mean, ideally, there's never an attack and you guys are golden. But the truth of the matter is, like you said, with all these IoT devices,
you're constantly attacked.
You're constantly attacked and somebody might get through. So do you help a lot with that too, of being able to recover in case something happens?
There are attacks every single day.
Right.
You may not hear about them, but they happen. You should go to a website called Shodan.io.
Do I really want to?
Maybe.
How do you spell it?
S-H-O-D-A-N.
.io?
.io. It's a researcher tool for basically all the vulnerabilities ever. This could be enterprise servers. This can be small IoT devices. And you can essentially look at specific vulnerabilities. So when the Mirai botnet happened, it happened in a particular way. You could look for that. Heartbleed, when that vulnerability and malware came out, you could look at Heartbleed and see all of the vulnerable devices worldwide.
Wow.
So for that, you can see 100% all of the vulnerable devices and attack devices. But in terms of us working on mitigation, we're not doing that right now, but it's on our roadmap. And we can certainly partner with organizations that already work with mitigation and then adding that into a blockchain piece.
Yeah.
But for right now, we're looking just on visibility.
Okay.
If you can't see what you're supposed to protect, you can't protect yourself.
Yeah.
You can't know what you're compliant with, and it's become a problem.
Okay, yeah. So I'm going to ask something very ignorant here, okay? So I'm on the site here, because I just was curious. And you're talking about Heartbleed, for example, devices vulnerable. This is a sample report. You have to actually create a login and all that stuff. But this is from 2016. They said the United States had almost 58,000 devices vulnerable to Heartbleed. That seems low to me.
Yeah, that does seem really low.
So I don't understand. I guess I don't understand the metrics here. And you're smiling at me like, okay, idiot, let me, grandma, let me explain this to you.
Let me school you.
It just doesn't seem very much. So help me understand.
The U.S. actually wasn't the main country attacked. It was the U.K. I mean, it was all over the place. But here's the thing. If I can connect to one of your servers.
Yeah.
Well, that, and then
Does it matter how many I infected?
Initially?
No, it doesn't. If I can connect to one server, if I can connect to one IoT device and transcend my way up to the network, get whatever admin credentials I need to just escalate that privilege, doesn't matter.
I see what you're saying.
One device makes you vulnerable.
So that's, now you depress me. Now I'm
depressed. No, that's why I don't want to know. Because I'm probably like on every single thing, it's my computer that's listed and my phone and all this. Okay, let's talk about the 5G. Now that, I mean, I'm guessing with 5G getting implemented everywhere, you're in way more demand, hopefully, right? How does 5G affect what's about to happen and what you're doing?
So in terms of 5G, AT&T and Verizon have the contracts first to be able to test it and deploy it in the U.S. And we're starting to see it in the Dallas area, at least on my phone.
Yeah, I've seen it a couple times.
They are testing that network. In terms of IoT, though, if I was to put a million, 2 million, a few million IoT devices into a city, we don't currently have the ability to use their bandwidth that we may need for the future, for efficiencies or workloads or anything related to that demand. With 5G, that increases the bandwidth, that increases the connectivity, so you can add extra devices all connected as one into one system and being able to manage those on a bigger scale. So 5G is going to take smart cities 1.0 to smart cities 3.0.
Yeah, to say, yeah, it'll be a jump.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And our city's really working to connect with you and try to figure this out too, knowing 5G is coming. Like, is that kind of lighting a fire under their butt?
Yeah. So one of the accelerators we're currently in is a US Ignite Smart Cities Accelerator. Well, they're a nonprofit, but they work directly with all the major cities around the US. They helped put in the gigabit network. So in Richardson and in Austin, those grants are going to those two cities in Texas alone, and they'll be the test beds for 5G and any type of technology that goes on top of 5G. So they were really the initiators, among other organizations, collaborating with them to make that happen.
So let's talk about these accelerators, because I'm really proud of you. You are like, you're rocking this right now. And it is a start. Novum is a startup. So let's talk about the community that, you know, these accelerators that you're a part of. So how did you find them, or did they find you? Because I think some of these accelerators, you have to be invited in, right? You're not simply just applying, or is it? I thought.
So it depends on the accelerator. We're currently in Mass Challenge Austin. They are a nonprofit. They don't take equity. They provide a global network of individuals to be able to mentor you and or business connections. They also provide their corporate partners for potential pilots or customer discoveries. So we're currently going through Mass Challenge Austin, and we're concurrently going through US Ignite Smart Cities Accelerator. They don't necessarily automatically accept you for Mass Challenge. For example, we had to go from two rounds of judging, where we essentially created a pitch deck, pitched it to them, showed them our team, what we're doing, and the importance of it, and they decide themselves if it's an important topic to solve. US Ignite is solely focused on smart cities. They're focused on areas that can benefit them, whether that's cybersecurity, AR, augmented reality, virtual reality, machine learning, AI, anything like that.
Hashtag super smart people.
Hashtag emerging technologies. Yeah.
Can you just go to add hashtag innovation while you're at it?
Hashtag right. Innovation.
No, but we talked about this Mass Challenge out of Austin. I was fascinated because it's not for profit. I'm like, what accelerator is nonprofit? I thought they're all about making money, right? Like a mm-hmm. cash grab on your blood, sweat, and tears. They're going to make some money somehow. So just to clarify, I know you're not a spokesman for them, but what do you get out of this? And what do they get out of it with you guys' cooperation?
So they are nonprofit. They're non-equity. And you're right. A lot of accelerators say, hey, cool, I'll take 3% of your company and hypothetically provide you with what you need to succeed.
And provide you.
Yes.
Quotes. I'll introduce you to some great investors, right?
Yeah. Right.
We're not hashtagging. We're
air quotes.
Air quotes. But Mass Challenge is different. And their focus isn't taking equity from your company, but you do have the opportunity to do a pitch or select companies out of the cohort. Can do a pitch on pitch day to essentially pitch to investors or pitch to organizations that might find what you're working on interesting to pilot or you know, partner with.
So this is what we're going about. Why we started this podcast in general was because we're working with a lot of major corporations that their innovation labs are struggling, or they don't know if they want to partner, collaborate, or acquire newer technologies, whatever fits into their, you know, future 5-year plan. 10-year plan, et cetera. So it strikes me as you guys are, in essence, almost like a cheater innovation hub for them.
Yeah. So what I've started seeing is these enterprise, typically they have, obviously, R&D, some of them, but not all of them, have innovation labs that may be anything related to 3 people up to 15, 20 people, depending on the innovation lab. Some don't have an innovation lab. But now, besides that, we're starting to see companies go to other types of innovation, whether that's hackathons or into accelerators to augment their R&D, to augment their innovation. And so to give you an example with Mass Challenge, the corporate partners for Austin are BAE Systems, and they have a great innovation lab within BAE. You also have the cities like Austin and Houston. You have the Spurs. You know, any. It doesn't have to be like a defense contractor. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be something related to cybersecurity. But you're seeing all of these different organizations, whether public or private, that are going into these at least non-dilutive nonprofits to augment their innovation. And similar with US Ignite, you have all of the big telecoms. You have Ericsson. You have Jupiter Networks. You have Cisco. And they're going into these because they want to see the emerging technologies that are coming out faster than they can even look at the opportunity.
Exactly. I was just going to say, you guys are so nimble. As startups, you've got that flexibility to pivot really quickly, as opposed to, you know, like an Ericsson, for example, a great supporter of our organization and our podcast. So props to Ericsson. Hurry up. Tell those people, hurry up with the 5G rollouts, please. So you mentioned hackathon. So let's pivot a little bit, because I'm using that word pivot. I learned it the other day, and now I'm using it every day. Hackathon. To me, I think it's fascinating because as a non-technical person, I'm not a coder, I'm not cool. I'm hearing about these hackathons all over the place. Last night, in fact, I was with the City of Allen folks, and they actually hosted hackathons out there. So help me understand your involvement, because you get so excited. We've talked about hackathons in the past, and I'm like, what the hell is a hackathon?
I have been involved putting on different types of corporate and government hackathons for the past few years. We held the largest Earth-related sustainability environmental hackathon, the largest in the world, in Dallas. Earth Day, Texas, or now EarthX.
Yes.
I've worked with MD5, which is the U.S. National Security Technology Accelerator, on any type of technology related to military, which could include machine learning, AI, physical uniforms that may have stuff embedded in them. I've worked with New York Life to do stuff related solely to blockchain and financials. I've worked with Boeing, AVL, a Boeing company, advisory for their event to look at ways that they can expand from, I think it was 3 to 5 billion to 10 billion in the next 5 years. And I spoke at their last year, I spoke at their strategic planning meeting. They have one, you know, one per year that focuses, and it's multiple days.
I was going to joke, hopefully it wasn't developing the Macs. I don't want to be tied to that hackathon, I'm just saying. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, but like, that's funny, I was on that team.
No, well, no, but you know, I've been involved in any hackathon, or you can even consider it an ideathon. It depends on where an organization is. They either want to see prototypes, or they want to just bring the most knowledgeable thought leaders in the space in their localized area, or not even their localized area, and to say, okay, we don't know what blockchain is. Tell it to us like we're five, because we need to understand. We want to do something with that. And so I can basically put those together. I wouldn't call them necessarily focus groups. I don't like the term focus groups. I sometimes don't think focus groups actually do what they're supposed to do.
Yeah.
So this is really just a knowledgeable type of internal event that I do with corporations. But yeah, so I've done that with blockchain specifically, AI, machine learning, environmental sustainability initiatives. One was for Freeman, which was just related to events. You know, Freeman, you've ever done anything at a conference.
Yes.
I mean, just Freeman alone, I just think about the logistics of pure logistics of coordinating all the vendors, just event planning on steroids.
All the inventory. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And the fact that there's like an inconsistent staffing too, because you got to rely on local. I mean, God, how many variables can mess up? So are hackathons basically a cost effective way for companies to inject some new blood into something, whatever concept they're looking at?
Yeah. So it actually, it goes even beyond the concept. So a lot of the companies that will have their own hackathons, external, but you can also have internal with your own employees, but your external, you essentially aren't necessarily even looking. You are looking for for solutions, but you're also looking for talent.
I was going to say, is this basically a mask for recruitment? Like,
absolutely.
Because that's where, I'll be honest with you, and this is not correct, but a lot of times when I think of hackathons, I think of kids, right? Like young kids. And I'm old enough, excuse me, that I can call a 21-year-old a kid. But I was thinking...
Speak for yourself, lady.
But it's like, I always think of like young kids coming in. So it's interesting on this perspective and to see his question that it could be just talent of any, you know, of any age, but yeah, to find
age,
talent.
Experience,
yes,
whatever
exactly.
It might be. Because I think it depends on the, again, it depends on what the subject matter is, right? But I do see a hackathon as being a way to increase STEM interest, right? To keep the high school kids interested, for example. I guess he has, for college students about to embark into the professional 100%. World to get some visibility. But I also see as postgraduate, like just people in general of like, okay, people that are employed, let's see you do what you can do.
But like if, and but to your point though, like if you're trying to get a hackathon and I'm like, okay, help me with blockchain. I can have kids come in, people come in and try to come up with a solution for a blockchain. But then is there the side to like, help me understand? It's almost like a, what's the word I'm looking for? Like a panel, like a expert panel coming in and kind of schooling me on it. Is it to that, or is it always we're trying to build something and create something and solve a problem?
Yeah. So typically at a hackathon, you have 1 to 3 challenges that you're trying to not necessarily solve, but you're trying to understand where the landscape is, what type of proof of concepts you can get in a 24-hour period. And that gives you a better idea of where you can invest more time or money into to be able to determine that. Now, there are different types of hackathons that you can create. One could just be for high school. It could be a generalized hackathon, which you know has anywhere from middle school, high school, college, and grads or people who have been in industry for 40 years. It depends on what your goals are and how you want to structure it. It's different when we did the MD5 hackathon for the US. Their participants that came in, they had been in the industry. They had been in the military. They understood the actual challenges that they were facing. And, you know, these are guys and girls that really wanted to solve problems, but never thought they could do it while they were in. And so you can do it in different ways. And you can also do internal hackathons. So your company's maybe not moving fast enough. They're not coming up with innovative ideas, or someone in that chain is stopping those ideas for one reason or another, whether they intend to or not. You know, it's subconscious where you're just used to saying no.
Yeah.
And internal hackathons can get you out of that. And you see it a lot in Facebook and other corporations where they'll do an internal hackathon where, and those are also structured differently because it shouldn't be an event that you're forcing your own employees to do something for you, something that they're already working on.
Right.
And I see a lot of corporations that try to do this themselves and then they end up basically making everyone hate them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, no, it's interesting. So Matt Johnson, you know, he was one of our guests for East Edge.
Yeah.
East Edge was developed from, he used to work for Bottle Rocket, and Bottle Rocket's very well known. I think they almost do like a monthly event or something where they encourage their employees to like curate and just, it's a kind of in-house hackathon where they just want to curate and figure out cool things that they can create. And his company was built out of that hackathon internally because he started playing with AR, VR and just determined it. So it's kind of cool that amazing thing can truly spring out of just those internal ones.
Well, and on that note, there have been some interesting companies that have spawned from hackathons. So GroupMe, which
I don't know what GroupMe is.
It's like a mass texting thing within an app. Is that the best way to describe
it?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's group texting within an app.
It's another thing to get a freaking thing and that people
Adam,
can message
stop looking
you.
At me like I'm your mother. He's like, yeah, it's a group text within an app.
Then there was one that wasn't a physical product or anything. It was an algorithm. It was an algorithm that was developed, and this algorithm allowed you to do essentially not 2-factor authentication that you would be used to, but it's an add-on to multi-factor authentication. So instead of just typing in a number that changes all of the time, you can now use your phone that has a specific signal on it, and each electronics has a different signal to unlock your computer. And a large conglomerate may or may not have asked them to join their company and then patented that. Now it's under that company. So you can see...
That's clever.
Yeah.
So well, because patents take money, too. So they're exactly. like, hey, you...
Yep. Yeah. So we want you because you are thinking different ways than everyone else in our organization. So we want that new blood and new thought process to try to shift our innovation hub, to shift our thinking. And I think we can all sit here and confirm that if you work in a specific industry for long enough, you look at those processes, you look at those procedures and things that are done in a specific way, and you just get used to them.
And you do them because that's the way it's done.
You do it because you don't want to rock the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm the totally opposite. I love to rock the boat.
Yeah.
I love to rock the boat. And hackathons can be some of those ways to recruit talent, but also find those proof of concepts. And even, so like with the New York Life one, when we did that hackathon at UTD, we ended up having some of the participants that had been interns at New York Life. They flew them in to wow. then work on proof of concepts of what they had learned about blockchain technology, you know, in the spring.
Yeah.
And then they said, this is great. Now we want to bring this underneath our umbrella to work on this. This is your project. You know, you've proven awesome. You've proven the concept out in 24 hours. You did the research originally as an intern. You learned about it, but you never developed something. So now that you've developed something, this is interesting. We want to move forward with R&D.
What a great opportunity.
I'm excited for those that have those types of skill sets. First off, to be able to be... Do you have to be invited into a hackathon as a participant? Or is it something you and your team apply to? Or
So it depends. If it's like a school hackathon, like Hack UTD or you know Hack MIT, those are more generalized hackathons. So if you go to school there or you go to a school in the surrounding area, you're most likely going to be accepted because those are mass hackathons with 500 plus people. You don't need a hackathon with even 50 people to find out who you want to hire, what you want to work on, because you've already developed some sort of challenge, an open-ended challenge to look at this technology in different ways.
Could this be part of the hiring process then now? Could companies basically kind of get free labor and say, okay, 50 people, we're going to put you all in a room and we've got 20 positions open and we've got a hackathon we'd like you to, as part of your interview process. I mean, are companies doing that now? Because I could see that as cream of the crop you're trying to get.
I've never seen that. That's a very interesting idea and I would love to work on it if somebody would want to do that with me.
Let's do it.
But...
Oh, new business idea. Okay.
But with that type of a hackathon, you know, you can definitely go that route, but typically within prizes, you know, to spend 24 hours of your time, you have some type of prizes, whether those are monetary or there's some type of physical product like a virtual reality headset or experiential. We've had companies in the past that say, hey, you get to hang out with our CEO or director of innovation for a day, learn from them and really understand where we're coming from and see if this is somewhere that you want to be.
Yeah.
Or you know, lunch with somebody high up that, you know, where your focus is, whether it's marketing or business or development.
I would think even just to start from like the external perspective of hiring, like just think about too, bringing internal and finding, you know, sometimes you get into a large company and people kind of get slated in certain areas and it's hard for them to be creative. You know, like we talked about a little bit, it's done because that's the way it is. But if you're put in a situation to think out of the box and you are designed to do that, you've just kind of been forced into a box for the past several years because that's the way the company works. It's big enterprise companies. It's very common. Imagine like maybe you can find some internal talent too that you're like, whoa, Johnny's got it going on. And I had no idea because he's been doing data for 10 years. You know what I mean? You just never know. Like, not that Johnny probably been doing data for 10 years, but you know what I mean.
Well, no. And I think that's the other thing is I think in this day and age too.
Or Sarah, sorry.
Johnny yet. I don't know. Johnette.
Anyway, I didn't want to be sexist, but go ahead.
Anyway, I think I'm seeing a shift as well, as far as in our past interviews, Aaron, we've been doing a lot of references to our past. We've been doing a lot.
Yeah.
We're getting there. So one of our previous guests, two actually in our Women in Tech Leadership series, two leaders actually had said, you know, have multiple lanes or have, you know, multiple paths in your career. So just because you have a computer science degree does not necessarily mean you don't have an opportunity in a somewhat parallel career field. I'm wondering if the hackathons also open that opportunity where we've seen a lot of journalists go into the world of security, which I don't understand that, but yet they've got that mind apparently to be inquisitive. I don't know, for security, but yeah, I've got five friends who have journalism degrees and they're all CISSP. I mean, they're all CISO types. It's like, why? I don't know, but it's just an aside I've seen.
Yeah, no, it definitely, we've seen it in hackathons. So for example, you have somebody in your company that may just code every day, but they do something with cloud and they have researched maybe machine learning algorithms, different ways to do things, but they've never been given an opportunity to try that out. Mm-hmm. And they've gone through a hackathon, presented this idea, said, look, I did this, this, and this. It's not something I do on my daily basis, but I'm really good at it and have proved this with a proof of concept. And they've ended up switching roles within organizations because Someone says, you are fantastic in cloud infrastructure and scalability, but man, we have absolutely nobody that understands machine learning, at least on a way that we can test something out.
Right.
And so we want to shift those responsibilities to you. So now you become that person that leads that.
For someone that organizes these hackathon events, what do you get out of it?
Personally, I like to see the different use cases. So for me, similar to what an enterprise is there for, they say, okay, what's new? What's innovative? What's the technology that we want to focus on? What are the business use cases? And, you know, all day long, you can read articles that say, oh, this technology is great for this. But until you actually do a hackathon or an event that you can do a proof of concept, you can't prove that out necessarily. So for that, I really like it, but I do it as a consultant as well. So, you know, per event or, you know, hourly basis, depending on if it's on an advisory type role or strategy to be able to figure out what they want to do and why they want to do it. So it can range anywhere. And I do that on a consulting basis.
Pretty brilliant. You get paid to research. I like it.
Oh, I know. I'm telling you, like, nothing makes Adam happier, I think, than to like have his nose in a virtual book, if you will, learn something new.
It's very true.
No, for real. Like we can talk about different various topics. And I think that's something that's really good about you. So bringing it back to then with Novum, then as a result of your involvement with hackathons, have you been able to shape Novum much more clearly and define it as you develop that from when you started the organization to today?
Absolutely. So from our past experience with identity and access management, my other partner managed the surveillance system of the city of Chicago. So it's the second largest in the nation. Based on our experience and my experience just from hackathons and being able to play with different technologies, absolutely. We've been able to better focus on where we want to solve, why we want to solve it versus a very broad approach. So yeah, it's been absolutely beneficial.
Yeah, I mean, just when you think about IT security, IoT, and around security of that, I've seen a lot of companies use that term very generically, and that's why I'm like, and as and I mean, as a startup, you have to have a differentiator, and almost like you have to be very clear on the depth of your expertise because you are the differentiator. And if they're looking to acquire you, partner with you, or collaborate with you, you have to fulfill that gap, whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and that's why I'm very fascinated by it. So, Adam, you are, we could talk all day with you, and I know I will still be lost like 90% of the time. And I love the way you always bring it back for me in a way that I can't understand it. So, Novum, is there anything that you'd like to share with us or highlight that we haven't talked about yet? Any new things or?
Well, because I can't resist myself. I've been in the esports industry lately.
It's a good place to be.
Researching that. Again, well, you think of it in terms of like innovation and new technologies, but how about entirely new markets?
Mm-hmm.
You know, esports, air quotes, was in the late 90s, early 2000s. We had a large Dallas presence, and then they all left. And now we're seeing that resurgence with Arlington Stadium, with
GameStop's whole center.
Well, not even that. So you have Jerry Jones, you know, mm-hmm. he invested in Complexity. You have multiple professional gaming organizations within the DFW area. You have stadiums that are starting up. You have curriculum now for middle schoolers and high schoolers that are starting up. You have collegiate teams, and that's a massive industry in itself. Anywhere from, you know, ad spend and analytics to how do you pick the best players? How do you look at their mental health as they're a player when they're in front of a screen for 16 hours? And how do you monetize this entire industry? So, yeah, it's just been, as I always do, I get really deep into the different types of industries and technologies that I can.
So crazy.
Esports to me is like the, if I'm going to want to spend some money and make investments, it's going to be within esports. If you think generationally, Gen X, of which we just talked about, and we're going to be posting that podcast in a bit, but Gen X has the financial means. They're the age group that actually grew up with video games, and it's evolved over time. And then the millennials, obviously, you've embraced it. I mean, you've got this huge market for esports to blow up, and it has. I mean, just the whole gaming concept is already surpassed Hollywood in terms of like revenue and expenditure, right? So think of all the underlying technologies that's going to be as a part of it and the result of it. It's so exciting.
Yeah, I remember the Hoop It Up game that I used to play. But I don't know if it was Hoop It Up or whatever. Like, they're real basic on Nintendo, and you play 3-on-3. You playing basketball. It's changed a little bit since then. I can't even play video games anymore because they're so over my head. I'm like, this controller is confusing me.
Oh, it's like so realistic. I'm like, wait, this person just gave me the Heisman. I'm like, ooh, when I do watch my boyfriend play the games, I just think of it as like a big cartoon that I get to direct.
Yeah.
He gets to do all the controls. I don't care about that. But I'm like, go left, go right, shoot, you know, whatever. So,
Adam, real quick, though, if somebody wanted to get a hold of you, learn more about Novum, where should they go?
You can email me at adam@novam.ai.
Okay. And we'll have that on our notes page over at innovationcalling.com.
Adam, you've been a gracious host and or guest.
Well, thank you very much.
It's the voice. It just automatically puts him in the host position.
I swear, we're going to make you the official voiceover guy. No, but thank you very much for your time. And I think that'll wrap it up for another episode of Innovation Calling.